is this thing that we are talking about providing something that a consumer who is me-centric will respond to? Yes or no? It's such a simple mechanism. And if the answer is no, then you don't do it and you stop talking about it. I know it seems like I'm oversimplifying things, but deciding what not to do is often more important than deciding what to do.
Welcome to the Simple Brand Podcast, the show dedicated to helping you create simple experiences for your customers and for your team members. Each week, we're bringing you amazing interviews with business leaders and authors who will teach you how to differentiate your business with the one thing your customers need the most, simplicity. Your customers live in a complex world. Let's make it simple. Now, here's your host, Matt Lyles.
When I think about how life is for me as a consumer today, I gotta say it's pretty good. And I'd say it's pretty good for you too. Think about it. You've got more options of places and channels to find what you want today than ever before. If your go-to place doesn't have what you're looking for right at this moment, someone else will. You can even think of a product you want that doesn't even exist, or even an existing product that you just want customized just for you, and someone will make it for you at a fairly reasonable price. You can get what you want pretty easily today. And that's great news for you as a consumer. But that's bad news when you realize that the same is true for your customers. In fact, we're at a point in time right now where consumers are armed with more information, more technology, more access to alternatives than at any point in history. And all this power has pretty much inverted the traditional power dynamics in the retailer-to-consumer relationship. Basically, your customers are now in charge, and they expect a lot more from you. And if you want to survive and even thrive in this new economy, then you have to recognize, embrace, and adhere to the new consumer demands. That can feel pretty overwhelming and intimidating and, well, downright scary. But that's why I was happy to talk with Joel Bynes this week. Joel co-leads the global retail practice at the business consulting firm Alex Partners. He's a frequent contributor to major media outlets like NPR, CNBC, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and he's now officially a published author. Joel's first book is out this week, The Me-Tail Economy, 6 strategies for transforming your business to thrive in the me-centric consumer revolution. Joel and I talk about this new retail industry power shift where the consumers are essentially now in charge. But thankfully, Joel shares his methods that retail brands can use to connect with the me-centric consumer and still thrive in this new world. So here it is. Here's my interview with Joel Bynes.
Hey, Joel, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Matt. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, well, welcome to the show. I'm excited that you're here.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, The Me-Tail Economy, is this your first book?
Yeah, first and only, I like to say. If I had known how difficult this was going to be, I may not have even gotten the first one out.
Oh, everyone that I talk to that has written a book always talks about it like having a child, like going through pregnancy and birthing a child.
Yeah, just in case my wife listens to this podcast, I won't compare it to that, but it was definitely difficult. There's no question about it.
Well, congratulations on it.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have really enjoyed digging into it. And as I was reading it, you know, one of the standout quotes that came to me was, today's consumer has more power than Louis XIV ever had. I love that quote.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. That was a fun idea to play with. A lot of people may not know or remember their French history, but Louis XIV was the Sun King. And that was because people literally thought the planets revolved around this man. And he pretty much invented what we think of as the luxury retail world right now. He was the king who commanded all of the best craftsmen in the world to come to him with all of the best crafts. And if you think about it from one sense of the world, he was basically the most powerful man, at least in the Western Hemisphere, in his era. But I can literally click a button and have something delivered to my house in less than 30 minutes right now, pretty much anything. So I kind of feel like I've got more power than Louis XIV. So I'm glad you found that interesting. That was fun to write about.
Oh, yeah. Well, it speaks to this power shift that you talk about with the me-tail economy. And if you think back hundreds, thousands of years, as long as people have been selling goods, the merchant, the retailer had a lot of control, a lot of power over the consumers. But we've seen this power shift now that you talk about. So what's driven this power shift?
I think it's three really core things. The first one, of course, is technology. So I don't mean e-commerce when I say technology. Obviously, e-commerce is just commerce, but it's the technologies that allow consumers to much more frictionlessly connect with the suppliers of the goods and services versus the way that they could do before the technology existed. The second is social media. It's hard to overestimate the impact of social media because individual consumers now have a voice, and that voice can be amplified so easily and so simply through the various social media mechanisms. And then the third is just sort of the gradual shift towards a world economy. Obviously, there are still trade wars and there's still geopolitical issues, but in general, there's been kind of a continuing migration towards thinking about a global supply chain. And when you put those three things together, you begin to see how what they've done is they've given consumers the power in the relationship. So the way I like to talk about it is, if I think about when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, if we needed to buy something, we had to go to a physical location. We had to observe the things that were available to be bought. And we either bought something or we didn't buy something. And in that sense, the people that were determining the products that were there had all of the power in the relationship. If they decided they were only going to have three toaster ovens, then I had to choose from one of three. If they decided they were going to have 30, I had more choice. And I could pick between those two retail type of environments. But today, it doesn't matter if a physical location has 330 or 300. If I don't see what I'm looking for, I'll just search until I find it. And once I have the power in the relationship, there are so many implications that come from it. And so you are correct. The core premise that drives the me-tail economy concept is this power inversion. And as you said, it's never happened before in the history of commerce.
Yeah. Well, you know, so I grew up in the 70s and 80s as well. And as I read through the first part of the book, all of a sudden, like something that I hadn't thought about in probably decades was when I was really young, there was a convenience store that we used to go to sometimes as a family. And I just happened to recall this. They had a sign in the store that said, "If we don't have it, you don't need it." And in my 6-7-year-old mind, like, that always stuck out to me. It was like, I don't know if that's true because I need G.I. Joe figures and you don't have G.I. Joe figures.
So
your sign can't be true.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Or, I mean, just to extend it to kind of a little bit of the absurd, I don't know what you were snacking on at the time, but I wasn't snacking on fiery hot Cheetos. I needed fiery hot Cheetos, but not only did they not carry it, but they didn't exist at the time. And if they didn't exist today, some individual consumer somewhere would have invented them and offered them for sale on an Instagram feed. And ultimately, my penchant for clicking on images of spicy food would have found me those fiery hot Cheetos that I would have never been able to find before. And so that's kind of a silly example, but that's sort of what I'm talking about. If I can't find what I'm looking for, I have so much power as a consumer now that I'll just go create it because the barriers to entry on every level are just simply so low.
That's it. It makes it so much easier now. So when we look at this at a high level, a lot of times, like, we'll see lots of media articles or people either in the news or even just, you know, in the community, just talking about the death of retail or the forecasted retail apocalypse, just all because of e-commerce. And so what you're saying is that's not really the case. Given the prevalence of e-commerce, we're not really seeing a retail apocalypse.
No, I don't believe we're seeing a retail apocalypse at all. I believe we're seeing a retail reinvention. So I tend to look at this as a really exciting time. And when I talk about what's going on, I talk about it as an exciting thing to participate in. But you hit the nail on the head when you said it's not e-commerce. There's a tendency to simplify cause and effect that, you know, just citizens of the world have. And it's too easy to say, well, Amazon has caused the death of brick and mortar retail. And that's kind of the theme. And it's also a lot more interesting to write about an apocalypse than it is to write about a long, slow reinvention, frankly. But right. The reality of the situation is, look, if you work for a retailer that is closing a store and you work in that store, then it's pretty apocalyptic. You have to find a new job. Maybe you work there for a long time. You're not working with friends and colleagues any longer. So it's not to say that there isn't this sort of death and rebirth, but that's always gone on in retail. Forever, there have been new models of retail. There have been general stores, and then there were catalogs, and there were main streets, and then there were superstores. And, you know, I'm missing a bunch of stuff. It's all just different versions of commerce. And as each of those versions have come through, there's been a shaking out of the old version. The difference today is that the consumer is at the center of this reinvention. And so if a retailer is going through the historical way of thinking about right-sizing their business, so they might say, okay, I've got 2,000 stores based on what we call four-wall profit analysis. All that means is just thinking myopically about one individual store after you account for all of the costs of operating that store. Is it making money? That's the old way of thinking. They go through that thought process and they might say, we need to close 200 stores. But if they went through a process of thinking about the value of that store to the broader consumer relationship, maybe it's being able to get product to them in 30 minutes or less. Maybe it's being able to demonstrate product if that's complicated, maybe it's providing advice, whatever it might be, then that store has a different value in the consumer first equation. And that's what I'm trying to get businesses that serve consumers to understand through the retail economy is almost everything that we've done in retail, at least over the last 30 years of my career in retail, isn't going to work when you start with accepting the premise that the consumer is in charge. And that's because the consumer has not been in charge before this moment in time. So we've never had to worry about it this way. So it's a fascinating set of discussions that you have. But for sure, getting back to your point about the retail apocalypse, it's not at all an apocalypse. It's a reinvention and it's a revolution. And it's just a ton of fun when you think about it that way.
When you approach it with that mindset, it's thinking of, okay, here's where things are heading. Now, how do we need to shift how we're doing? How do we need to change? How do we need to evolve in order to stay with how the industry, how consumer mindsets are evolving? And if we talk about how consumer mindsets and consumers are evolving and having that consumer-centric approach, it centers around what I think you describe as like the me's or a me-centric consumer.
Yeah.
So how do you define a me-centric consumer?
So I think there's two ways to think about the me-centric consumer. At the simplest, kind of the blink level, the concept of a me-centric consumer helps me at any rate and has helped other people that have seen the book and that I talk to about this really understand what we're talking about, which is make it about me. I am the center of my world and I want you to treat me as though I am the center of your world. So it's that me, that consumer in the middle, and everything being built around serving that consumer. So that's at the high level of the concept. But the deeper level of the me-centric consumer is the fact that really what you have is you have a democratization of the consumer economy now, because each individual person as a person isn't a demographic, they're an individual, and also isn't static. So one of the concepts that I talk about in the book is this notion of the quantum consumer.
Right.
Now, I was a philosophy major in college, so my last science class was probably eighth grade biology, but there's a concept in quantum physics about a particle being able to exist in two locations simultaneously. And I found that to be something that was very analogous to how I feel about the consumer. You and I are not monoliths. And at the same moment in time, we could be two entirely different consumers. And marketers have historically not thought about consumers that way. They've thought about consumers in clusters, in cohorts, in demographics. They've worked hard to develop personalization engines, but personalization engines are simply predictive tools based on past behavior. Right. And that's like driving your car by looking in the rearview mirror. It's useful so that I don't get emails from a retailer for women's clothing or something like that. But it's not so useful in the real true personalization sense, in the sense of I walk into my local store and the person who works there knows me, understands what I bought before, maybe knows where I went on vacation and that sort of stuff. That's real personalization. And that technology really can't replace it. So it's this concept that not only are the calling the shots, right? You have to get me individually to respond. It's an order of magnitude harder than it used to be because I am not the same person in the same moment in time. And so that makes the job of a marketer exponentially more difficult these days.
Oh, absolutely. And I like how you talked about how marketers have traditionally focused on, you know, segmentation, demographic groups. There's a meme that was created a handful of years ago and that got popular again, I think a couple of weeks ago, comparing Prince Charles to Ozzy Osbourne and the fact that they're part of the same demographic. You know, they're both born and grew up in England, both born, I think, in the late 40s. Both married twice, both have two children, all these things that show that they're essentially part of the same demographic. But when you look at them as individuals, completely separate people with separate needs and separate goals and challenges and personalities.
That's fascinating. That's hysterical and fascinating. I haven't seen it. I'm going to go look for it right after this. And it is exactly the point. And unless you understand something beneath the demographics, you will never get to that level of understanding that those are two separate individuals. Now, I take it one step further, and I say that each of them are also quantum consumers.
Right.
So I certainly have no idea what Prince Charles is into, but maybe he's into death metal, and that's a private thing. But if you know that at the individual level, then you know you can market to him. But that just adds a huge degree of complexity because 85% of the time, he's only buying tickets to classical music concerts or what have you.
Right. Yeah.
That's the level of understanding we are talking about businesses at this point. They've got to build their operating models around that concept. This is what I'm saying. It's not so much that I have the answers to exactly how do you do everything differently. What I have is the answer to the question of what is the next 25 or 50 years of serving consumers going to look like? The answer to that question is the consumers are going to decide what it's going to look like, not the companies. And that is such a fundamental shift in thinking that when it struck me, I felt like it was worthy of trying to write a book. And 3 years later, I've got one coming out. That's where we are.
There you go. And so with that, in order to meet those consumers as they're the ones calling the shots, you offer six strategies for retailers. Can you share those strategies?
Absolutely. So I wouldn't necessarily call them strategies, not to nitpick, but okay. What I try to do in the book, so basically the first half of the book makes the case for the me-tail economy. It describes the quantum consumer, and it kind of takes you through an arc of history about the way retail was and the way retail is changing and the implications that are embedded if you accept the concept that, as I like to say, it's not you, it's me. The consumer is in charge. The consumer has both agency and power now, as opposed to just agency. The second half of the book is really about how you build relationships with consumers. And so it's not so much that you would necessarily call them strategies in the way that sort of strategy consultants would talk about strategy.
Right.
But they're just ways human beings relate to other human beings. And this is in a retail context. So anyway, not to belabor the point, but there's six of them. So my hypothesis is these are the six ways that you can make connections with me's. In other words, these are the six things that go through the me's mind when they think about whether to shop at your store or take advantage of your service or eat at your restaurant or join your company as an employee or whatever the case may be. One is cost. The second is convenience. The third is category expertise. The fourth is curation. The fifth is customization. And the sixth is community. And so I was playing on the four C's of the diamond industry. I wound up with six C's. But if you think about each of those individually, you kind of understand what cost means. You understand what convenience means. You understand what category expertise means and so on. And the thing that businesses have to figure out is around those six, and I don't believe anyone could just pick one, think of them as ingredients. It's like the great retail cooking show. You have six ingredients in front of you, and you have to cook your own dish that your consumers are going to want to eat. But those are the six ingredients that you have to work with. So anyway, that's the second half of the book. And then I go pretty deep into each of those six C's, and I kind of give lots of examples of what it means and companies that are doing a good job and companies that could be maybe doing a little bit better job. And my hope is that everyone reading the book will see some of themselves in these six C's. So that's, say, first half, second half. There's also an addendum to the book, which is kind of like a what do you do about it?
Yeah.
We call it an executive action plan. But that's more for retailers or consumer business leaders that are thinking about, okay, I get this concept of me-tail. I like the six C's. I'm not really sure where to start. So that's what the little addendum is about.
Yeah, love that. Love having that kind of action guide, that playbook at the end. But when you think about these six C's, I like how you created the analogy of it being ingredients where you can make a recipe. And so that's to say that you can't, nor you should, use all six of these equally, but you also shouldn't focus on just one. Right?
Correct. A store like Building 19 and a half, which was in the Northeast where I grew up, and there was a closeout retailer, they were 100% a cost play. There was nothing convenient about them. There was nothing curated about them. There was nothing that was building any sort of a community. It was just a bunch of stuff dumped in a giant warehouse that you had to dig through, but you knew it was going to be the cheapest stuff you could find.
Even their coffee was cheap, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And today you have that same hard discount model. You have that same off-price model, but unless there's some element of other C's, consumers just won't respond. They're not willing to work as hard as we were willing to work back in the 70s and 80s. And so, yes, I agree. I don't think that anyone could choose one of the C's. I also really encourage people to deeply think about what they mean. I talk to a lot of business executives. Convenience is one that's always sort of misunderstood. And my question back to the business leaders is always, is it convenient for you? Or is it convenient for your customer? And the point is, if you're going to use convenience heavily in your dish, then the conveniences all have to be consumer conveniences. They cannot be business conveniences. If you're finding yourself talking about how much money you could save by introducing this service, you've already missed the point about what convenience means. It's not convenience to you, the business. It's convenience to your consumer. Generally, that sort of convenience actually adds cost. So that's just an example of how important it is to really understand this idea that the me's are in charge, and also this idea that the C's are designed from the consumer's lens, not from the company's lens.
Excellent. Did you know that in addition to my podcast and my articles, I speak to audiences all over to help them simplify their customer experience and simplify their employee experience? I've spent the last few years leading a crusade of simplicity across the globe. If you want a winning brand,
You have to provide a simple experience to your customers and to your team members. Whether it's a live event or a virtual event, I'd love to partner with you and teach your audience how to do just that. With over a decade in marketing, I know how to hook and captivate an audience. And as a speaker, I know how to connect with that audience. Along with my lessons, I use stories and humor to keep everyone engaged and inspired. Then they leave with the knowledge and next steps to transform their business. As an event planner, you're managing lots of details to give your audience the most memorable event. The last thing you need is a speaker who will make your event memorable for all the wrong reasons. Not only will I leave your audience energized and inspired, I'll make it easy for your team to work with me. Hey, if I've built my brand around simplicity, then you know I'm going to make it simple for you. When you visit mattlyles.com/speaking, you'll find everything you need to know, including details on my topics, promotional materials, and most importantly, a link to connect with my team so we can book your event. So visit mattlyles.com/speaking. I can't wait to help your audience brand out from the crowd.
I appreciate you explaining that, because as I was going through some of these, like, I had the question, well, some of these seem difficult to compete on if you're competing on just this approach. And I was thinking about competing on cost. Like, to me, it seems difficult to have a preferred brand while competing on cost. But you call out some retailers like Ollie's, like Five Below, that have done just that. So how have those retailers been able to focus on competing on cost alongside some of the other C's that they offer in their experience?
So Five Below and Ollie's are very interesting examples, because let's take them separately. So Five Below and Ollie's are both cost competitors. There's no question about it. And if you're listening to this and you're not familiar with either of the chains, look them up. And if you have one near you, you should go, because they're really fun retail experiences, but they're somewhat different. So Ollie's is a closeout retailer that builds and merchandises stores like a traditional mass retailer. So what I mean by that is, instead of having closeout stuff jumbled around and in giant boxes and really messy stores, they have very clean stores. And you would never confuse it for a Walmart or a Target, but you definitely wouldn't confuse it for a building 19 and a half. Right. So if you're a shopper at an Ollie's, you know exactly where the toothpaste is at your local Ollie's. And when you go, you may not find Crest every time. You might find AIM or Colgate or something else, but you know exactly where to find the toothpaste or the reading books for your children or the consumer electronics or whatever it is. So they merchandise it more like a store, which is much more convenient for a shopper, because these days we don't want to spend lots of time digging through stuff. So they are cost and convenience and some other things. There's a lot of fun associated with it. So they build a bit of a community around the people who shop there. Five Below is different. The people who started Five Below essentially started a business with what I think is just one of the most fundamentally genius concepts of all time, which was they saw the incredible success that the dollar store categories were having, Dollar General and so forth. And essentially, they basically said, geez, I wonder if we sold everything for $5 and less, what we could carry. And that simple change was that they were basically a dollar store, but it was $5. And so the fact that they were selling stuff for $5 and less, and little secret here for anybody that doesn't know this, dollar stores sell stuff for more than a dollar. So it's $5-ish. It allowed them to compete in all kinds of categories that a traditional dollar store couldn't compete in. And so they are curation. So what they've done at Five Below is they've thought of all of the categories that they can carry products in. And then they've curated really interesting products in each of those categories so that when you walk into Five Below, you're going to find something fun and interesting and unusual every time you walk in there. But you're also going to feel like you got a really good bargain because you know everything's $5 or less. So there's so many ways, once you understand the six C's and you know what your consumers want, there's so many ways to cook a really interesting and tasty dish when you break it down that way. The problem is that you just have so many legacy businesses that are unwilling to rethink everything that they're doing from the consumer lens first and work backwards. But when I work with companies that are willing to do it that way, it's amazing how simple everything becomes, because the guiding principle is this thing that we are talking about providing something that a consumer who is me-centric will respond to? Yes or no? It's such a simple mechanism. And if the answer is no, then you don't do it and you stop talking about it. I know it seems like I'm oversimplifying things, but deciding what not to do is often more important than deciding what to do.
Oh, wow. That makes sense. And especially like once you take that viewpoint and recognize, or you take yourself as the retailer out of the center of the world,
correct,
and then replace yourself with the consumer. And then that helps you more easily understand how to answer those questions. Should we do this or not?
That is exactly correct. That is how you simplify the agonizing process of meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting to debate whether we're going to launch a new service or a new product or a new location or a new banner or what have you. Sort of stops the room cold when you ask the question that way, because most businesses don't operate that way. That's not the way most business executives are rewarded, and it's not the way most business executives have been classically trained, because the consumer was never in charge.
But now they are.
Exactly.
Well, so one of the things you talked about a moment ago with Ollie's and Five Below was convenience. And that's another one of your, you know, six C's. So I'm curious, what are some methods that retailers are using to provide more convenience today that's really resonating?
Well, it's an interesting one to unpack, because there is the follow Amazon convenience strategy, right? So it was Amazon launched Prime and competitors launched something similar. Amazon went from two-day delivery to next-day delivery and companies chased that. And Amazon went from next-day delivery to same-day delivery and customers chased that. And often what I observe is execution without strategy. This assumption that, well, if Amazon is doing it, then that's what my consumers need as well. And they haven't really stopped to ask whether their customers need 30-minute delivery or guaranteed windows or anything. And the contrast to that is Target, which I'm sure everybody listening to this has either shopped in one or knows of one. But Target, long before any of these things were obvious consumer benefits, basically set their business up around their consumer. Their CEO, Brian Cornell, pretty much said to Wall Street, we know what we need to do because we're listening to our consumers. We also know that you, Wall Street analysts, are not going to like it. You know, they were investing tens of billions of dollars in their stores at a time when everybody was writing about how stores are dead. They went out, they bought a local last mile delivery company back at a time when people thought the valuations that they were paying were crazy and their stock price got hit. But what happened was, as the me-centric consumer got more and more power, they were responding to the changes that Target was making because the changes were made with the consumer in mind. They were listening to them. And so it's not so much the mistakes that companies make operationally. It's the mistakes that companies make by not stopping and asking themselves, convenient for whom, right?
Right.
Maybe it's convenient generically, but it may not be a convenience that my customers care about. Or maybe it is a convenience my customers care about, but we can't provide that convenience effectively and still make money. So it's not something we should do. But instead, what happens is I see a lot of this just copycat mentality. And then it's like, oh, we'll just figure out how to institutionalize it later. And that's just not going to work.
Yeah. And that still doesn't place your consumer at the center of the world. In a sense, that kind of places your competitor at the center of the world and just kind of seeing what they do and then trying to replicate that.
Very well said. That's as well as I've heard the issue articulated. You are focusing on your competitor, not your customer. And by the way, that is what I observe most companies do. They talk about their competition.
Right.
They talk about their relative market share. They talk about their positioning with respect to their competition on customer service scores and what have you. All of that stuff is interesting. But if you're not starting from the premise of the customer that you have is in charge of the services you need to supply to them, then you've just missed the point.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll limit yourself to focusing on only being as good or hopefully better than your direct competitor when your consumer may see you and your direct competitors as really both of you not that great, whereas they're getting experiences elsewhere that they expect you to provide, whether it's your competitor or not. So like Domino's Pizza, my kids love Domino's Pizza. And what is so cool is watching their pizza tracker, where you can see it being made online. But then when it's in the car and being delivered to your house, you can literally track it driving through your neighborhood. And so if I can see my Domino's Pizza coming through my neighborhood, then I now expect that for anything being delivered to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is true that really forward-thinking competitors, and a lot of people don't think of Domino's as a technology company or an e-commerce company. People ask me all the time, you know, who are the best e-commerce retailers out there? And I always, Domino's is always on my list.
Yeah, they are.
People say, Domino's, they're not an e-commerce player. I say, absolutely they are. The pizza tracker, they had the geofencing before anybody else did. They could deliver you a pizza in a park,
right,
or in a parking lot or some location that wasn't a house. They thought about the ecosystem that they needed to put in place to allow people to feel like they could get access to their favorite pizza anywhere they wanted, and they sold a lot more pizza. Those forward-thinking companies have definitely raised the bar for all companies. So it's not the case that you could just stick your head in the sand and ignore the fact that there is a ruthless competitor out there that's constantly pushing the boundaries of what is a consumer benefit. But it doesn't mean that copying the thing later and less effectively is an effective strategy. And I think too many businesses sort of think that as long as they are late and not quite as good as Amazon or Domino's, but they offer something similar, then that's good enough. And that's just simply not good enough. There's just nobody's going to reward someone for being second and less good at some consumer benefit.
No, that's not sustainable at all.
Right, exactly.
One of the other C's you talk about is customization. And if I'm thinking about being able to serve mass groups of consumers and trying to grow my consumer base, customization seems like a costly endeavor. So how can retailers focus on that while still appealing to a mass group?
This is one that is a function of the third reason underpinning the retail economy, which is this globalization of supply. So what's interesting is this customization would not be something that most businesses could embed into their kind of standard operating model if not for massive, massive, massive leaps in manufacturing techniques, supply techniques, and then global logistics techniques. So this is one that is here at a moment in time because the ability to provide customization has caught up with the consumer's desire to have that made-for-me feeling. At the same time, there are a lot of things that are viewed as custom by consumers that are not, in fact, custom. They're much more custom than you can buy a white shoe or a black shoe, but they're not fully custom in the sense that you can absolutely anything that you want and embellished any way that you want. That kind of truly bespoke customization model is still reserved for people that make stuff one at a time. But in between mass production and individual production is the ability to give your consumer the sense that the consumer is making enough choices so that the thing that they're ordering feels like it's custom made just for them. That's the balancing act. So it used to be prohibitively expensive to do something like that if you were an apparel manufacturer or a footwear manufacturer or what have you. But as technology has advanced, it's become easier and easier to manufacture things in small batches or even in batches of one. I always like to sort of challenge people's thinking a little bit on this topic. And I say that today we're thinking about Nike ID as customization, but tomorrow my grandchildren are basically going to be 3D printing their shoes at their house.
Right.
So there won't even be a retailer in the middle of something like that in the future. And there won't be FedEx dropping it off. And imagine that world, which is further advancement in technology. And imagine the metaverse, where we're not even talking about physical products. The sense of having that made for me feeling, which is what the customization C is all about, that is a core thing. That is something consumers have always wanted. They've always wanted the ability to have some voice in their product or service or experience. So if that's your chosen C, thankfully, because of advances in technology, you can do a lot more of that than you might otherwise think.
Oh, okay. So thankfully, you know, to your point, it's not necessarily always that true bespoke customization like a Savile Row suit tailor. It's more of the perception of customization.
Yeah, people would say mass customization or the illusion of customization, but somewhere between you can have any color you want as long as it's black, and you can pick every single component of your $5 million Bugatti. Somewhere between those two ends of the spectrum, almost every company that's selling almost any product can give their customers the ability to make more choices rather than fewer choices. And that's what the customization C is about.
Excellent. And so when people are talking about that as a possibility, hopefully that feels less intimidating to leaders and in the C-suite thinking, well, how can we customize? So
exactly.
That's good. And I have to admit, I was today years old when I actually learned where the term bespoke came from. And I learned that from your book. I love that story.
Thank you.
That suit bespoke for, sir.
That suit, it's not even that suit. It's that material. You couldn't even have a single-breasted suit made if Winston Churchill, for example, right, had a double breast. If that fabric was used, you couldn't use it.
Yeah, it was on the fabric. That's right.
That fabric bespoke for, sir.
Love it. There's a few other C's that people can take on, and I want to give people the opportunity to read about those in the book. But I'm thinking, you know, after someone reads your book and they're coming into their leadership, they're coming in, you know, to the next leadership or board meeting that next Monday, that Monday morning.
Yeah.
So how can they start this process to understand how to be successful in the new me-tail economy?
I think that the number one thing that people can do is to start to introduce the concept of the quantum consumer and the me-tail economy into the conversations that they're having that are sort of strategic and maybe linked to operating stuff. I don't think that someone finishes the book on a Sunday night and then on Monday morning, they walk in and play 52 card pickup with whatever it is that they're doing, their marketing plan or their store rollout plan or their online plan or whatever it is. I think that what needs to happen is a lot of dialogue that first talks about, well, are the me's in fact in charge? Are consumers in charge? And works through a process where you, by process of elimination, you realize that, holy smokes, they actually are. Every single thing that we do, that we think we are in control of, we are not, in fact, in control of. Where we source our raw material, how much we pay our suppliers, how much we charge for product, how often that we discount our product, all of that stuff. Every single piece of information that used to be hidden and proprietary is now easy to find. If not the specific manufactured cost of a Nike shoe, you can at least find out how much a sneaker made in Vietnam costs. And in fact, you can buy shoes from factories in Vietnam yourself right now. So that's the dialogue that you need to have. And whether you're thinking about your marketing plan, whether you're thinking about your hiring plans, whether you're thinking about your geographic expansion plans, start asking the questions, would we do it the way that we're doing it right now? If we accepted the premise that we don't have any control over how this is going to work, the consumers are in complete control. And if the answer is yes, then it's simple. You keep doing what you're doing. But if the answer is no, then you step back and you start to put these questions through the lenses of the six C's, time will tell. But my hope is that 5 years from now, no one even remembers where the phrase me tail came from, but it's just everywhere. Because to me, that is the reason I wrote the book. The reason I wrote the book is for centuries, millennia really, we've had a retail economy. And the retail economy is defined by consumers having agency but not power. But we now have a me-tail economy where they have agency and power. My premise is that changes almost everything that almost every consumer-oriented company is going to be doing. Maybe not wholesale, maybe not 180-degree turn, but even a 10-degree turn directed towards a me-centric consumer is going to give a business much, much better opportunity to succeed over the long term. That's my hope. This isn't march in, drop the book on your boss's desk and say everything we're doing is wrong. And if we don't, you know, if we don't change course tomorrow, we're dead. It's not that kind of thing.
No, there you go. It's taking a look at, you know, some of those decisions that you're making and maybe even some of your most recent decisions and saying who was at the center of that decision. Was it the consumer? If yes, hooray. If not, let's rethink.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I want to pull it away from the retail and consumer relationship for just a moment, because as I was reading through this, I got to thinking, you know, in the retail economy, I'm curious if there's a correlation with how the same consumers are changing the power shift in employment that we're seeing right now, like in the, whether you call it the great resignation or the great reshuffling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fantastic point that you're making, Matt. And it, the answer is 100% yes. I've focused my book on the consumer economy because that's where I've spent the entirety of my 30-year career. But the concept of agency without power and agency with power translates to just about any question that deals with human beings. And the Great Resignation is a perfect example of what I'm talking about. It's just so much different today where consumers actually have choice. They actually have access to lots of information about other jobs. They're mobile. They can work from home. They can work in a hybrid environment. They've taken control of situation in a way that if you go back 20 years, we just simply didn't have that kind of control. Sure, we could change jobs. Everyone always had the opportunity to quit and go do something else, but it's never, ever been as easy as it is now. So that's a great point that you make. If you're the head of HR, you need to understand the concepts of the me-tail economy. I'm not necessarily sure that my six C's are exactly right if you're thinking about how to do this with a people lens. But I know for sure that the concept that the me's are in charge applies in an employment context as well. So that's a really great extension of the concepts of the book.
Oh, yeah. And I can see how some of those C's, whether it's convenience, customization, curation, community, I think some of those can tie to it. But really, I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier about what are those decisions that you're making and who is at the center of those decisions?
Yeah.
Is it us as leadership in the company or is it our employees as the consumer of our employee experience?
Yeah. And are you making individuals feel like individuals?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Joel, last question for you. If you were to create a 5-song soundtrack for the me-tail economy, what songs would you include?
I just love that question. I'm sure everyone has the same reaction. Look, I'm a classic rock guy, so I'm in that sleeve of music. But I guess let's say my first one would be Tom Petty, I Won't Back Down.
Nice.
Because, you know, of course, your consumers are not backing down. Second one, obviously, is Rolling Stones, Satisfaction. Ooh. I hear that song in my head all the time as a consumer. I was thinking that Fleetwood Mac, Go Your Own Way was a pretty good one. I know Fleetwood Mac is current these days with the TikTok memes and so forth, but Go Your Own Way is a good one. The Who, Won't Get Fooled Again. That's another really good one. You know, and then my last one is cheesy, but I like it a lot just because I love the song, but I also like the concept, which is John Lennon's Imagine.
Oh.
That's really what I'm asking people to do with this book is just imagine a world where your consumers are calling the shots.
That's it. Well, it's that they're calling the shots, but that you can still have this, there's still this opportunity for a strong relationship with them.
Absolutely. Yep. You bet. You don't have to give up.
There you go.
That's the point. You're not abdicating everything to the consumer. And you're basically saying, oh, well, there's nothing we can do. So we'll just open our stores and hope people come. You're absolutely right. There has to be a relationship. And that really, at the root, the book is about relationships and how you build real relationships with individuals. And that just hasn't historically been required to be a successful retailer.
Yeah, that should be the goal right there, is how can you create and manage and sustain real relationships.
Bingo.
Well, Joel, I have learned a lot from the book and I've learned a lot from our discussion today, but where can people go to learn more from you?
Well, you can find a lot about me and the book at themeetaileconomy.com. There's a bunch of excerpts of the book. There are some background information about me and some other things there. And then, of course, anyone that is interested in what we do at Alex Partners is welcome to check out my LinkedIn bio, send me a connection. I love to meet new people. And I guess Google maybe is the best way to answer that question. I'm not really sure in today's age how else anybody would find out about me.
Well, and the point is too that you're out there. People can just search and simply find you. It's not hard to find you.
Yeah, I'm around. I'm definitely around.
There you go. Well, Joel, I've really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for being here today.
Matt, it was really my pleasure and I loved our discussion. I really can't thank you enough for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed my discussion with Joel Bynes. So go ahead, go check out The Meetail Economy. It's out today. And if you're enjoying the Simple Brand podcast, go ahead, hit the subscribe button. It's going to make it a lot simpler for you to get future episodes like the next one featuring John Pico. John is the founder of Watermark Consulting. He's a keynote speaker, and he's one of the most noted authorities on customer and employee experience. He's been featured by dozens of media outlets like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, NBC News, and Forbes. And John is the author of From Impressed to Obsessed, 12 Principles for Turning Customers and Employees into Lifelong Fans. John and I discuss his lessons around building customer loyalty by not just shaping experiences, but also shaping customer memories. And John shares some of his 12 customer experience principles along with how they can be applied to most any type of business. And thankfully, John and I are on the same team. The team that says that if you want to have a remarkable customer experience, you must have a remarkable employee experience as well. So go ahead and subscribe. You'll automatically get John's episode as soon as it's live. Until then, keep it simple.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Simple Brand Podcast. Want to make your listening experience simple and automatically receive each new episode? Visit our website, simplebrandpodcast.com, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. If you're finding value from the Simple Brand Podcast, leave us a rating or review. That helps us get the show to the ears of the people who need it most. Be sure to catch Matt right here next week. Same Matt time, same Matt channel. Until then, keep it simple.